Our study continues in the 20th chapter of Ezekiel. In this chapter, God is showing why the people must go into captivity, why he's going to have to destroy Judah, Jerusalem, and why there's going to be a total obliteration of the nation. We're now ready to begin in the 15th verse, and he's said up to this time that he led them out of Egypt, even though they had rebelled against him while in Egypt. He overlooked that rebellion enough so that he wouldn't have to destroy them. He led them into the wilderness and then gave them a law. And even while in the wilderness, they rebelled against him. And his first thought at the time of that rebellion was to bring his wrath upon them, to pour out his fury upon them in the wilderness, to consume them. But it says in verse 14, "But I wrought for my name's sake, that it should not be polluted before the heathen in whose sight I brought them out." So because of his name's sake, because of the fact that he didn't want the heathen to think, those Egyptians who were watching on and those nations round about who were observing this situation, he didn't want them to think that he just brought them out here to destroy them and never intended to fulfill his promise anyway of giving them this land of Canaan. So he withheld. He wrought for my name's sake. That is, he worked with himself, and he decided that he would not bring about their total destruction. But he couldn't let this sin go by unnoticed, unpunished, unattended to. So he says in verse 15, "Yet also I lifted up my hand unto them into the wilderness, that I would not bring them into the land which I had given them, flowing with milk and honey, which is the glory of all lands." So these people who had actually committed the sins against him in the wilderness, those who had rebelled against him, he did lift up his hand against them. Sin had to have some acknowledgement, some punishment, as it always does. And even though this people had eventually gotten forgiveness of this sin, they were able to continue to worship God. Still, as a result of their sin, they were not allowed to go into the land of Canaan. And we read about this in Numbers 14, beginning with the 22nd verse. He says, "Because all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles, which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and have tempted me now these 10 times, and have not hearkened unto my voice, surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers, neither shall any of them that provoke me see it." Then he gives the exception. Of course, Caleb could go in, and so could Joshua. But just as surely as he lifted up his hand for them, in favor of them, to bring them out of Egypt, here he is said to have to lift up his hand against them or unto them, that he would not bring them into the land of Canaan. This land that he describes as being flowing with milk and honey, which is the glory of all lands. So God had to reconsider his actions toward his people. Because of their unfaithfulness, their disobedience, here he says they have tempted me these 10 times. He brought them right up to the very brink of the land of Canaan, and they refused to go in. They were rebellious, they were stubborn, they broke all of his laws, they wouldn't keep the Sabbaths. Because they'd done these things, then God felt like he should just completely destroy them. But because of the glory of his name, he elected not to destroy them, but just not let them ever go into the land of Canaan, not the people who had committed these sins. And he re-explains the reason for this in verse 16, "Because they despised my judgments, and walked not in my statutes, but polluted my Sabbaths, for their heart went after their idols. Other things were in their heart besides God," besides the things of God. And we can find ourselves in precisely this same situation today if we will just let ourselves do it. We can find ourselves having our heart going after other things besides God, and in whatever else we go after, it turns out then that it's going to be an idol. Our greatest danger today, of course, is to fall into the trap of following the traditions that others have handed down to us for worship instead of what the Bible says for us to do. And anytime a person or a people refuse to follow the judgments of God, refuse to walk in his stated limits or his statutes, then they are said to be despising his judgment. They have denied, refused, turned down the wisdom of the Almighty God that's been offered to them. And that's what these people did. And it says they polluted my Sabbaths. Now, of course, the Sabbath, as we discussed in an earlier lesson, was a sign between them and God that God had brought them out of this land of Egypt. And it was the weekly service by which they set aside a holy day and recognized and worshiped God. And we find that the first step towards turning away from God is to fail to assemble, to fail to formally carry out the items of worship which God has prescribed for us to do. Now, of course, our worship today is not the same as theirs then. We do not have the burning of the incense, the offering of the animal sacrifices, the table of showbread, and so on. But we do have very definite things prescribed for us to do today, things that are to be done in a specific way and at a specific time. And those who begin to fade away from, who begin to fail to observe those duties, this is the first step then towards leaving God. You're going another direction. And although we do not keep the Sabbath day holy today, it's the same as polluting the Sabbath to fail to carry out the recognized, orderly worship of God which He has prescribed for us to do. And we can be said then to have a heart that's gone after our idols when we're putting something else in the place of God. Verse 17, he says, "Nevertheless, mine eye spared them from destroying them, neither did I make an end of them in the wilderness." So he let them live. He just simply said, you can't go into Canaan. And so he gave them 40 years to live out their lifetimes. So after this grievous sin, they had approximately another 40 years to live if their life would have naturally extended to that length of time. And so he was quite lenient, you might say, in that he let them continue to live out their lifetime, but he would not let them go into Canaan. Sin was not without its punishment. They were refused the privilege of going into this land of milk and honey, this land which he described as being the glory of all lands. So this generation then had so completely turned from God that he gave them up as not being worthy, not being fit or suited to go into Canaan. But what about their children? Verse 18, "But I said unto their children in the wilderness, walk ye not in the statutes of your fathers, neither observe their judgments, nor defile yourselves with their idols." So, in the wilderness now, God made another agreement with the children. If you will do what I want you to do, if you'll walk in the ways that I want you to walk, if you'll not go after these idols of your fathers, then we're going to have a new agreement, a new covenant. I'll take you and treat you just as though you were the original generation that had come out of Egypt, just as though you were the ones that are the total object of all of my glory and my privileges and promises. But I just ask that you not do like your fathers did. So you see how God then is pleading with this people to, even though their fathers had been forced to die in the wilderness, he's pleading with them, follow me and I'll make an agreement with you. So we're now talking to the next generation. God's talking to their children. Of course, these people that had committed these 10 temptations against God, or great sins against God, he'd already given them up. They no longer were going to be qualified for Canaan. But now the next generation, their offspring, those that were the age of 20 or under, that's who he's talking to here. And that's who he's wanting to try to salvage now. He gives them an opportunity to be salvaged. But he says, do not walk after the statutes of your fathers. Do not observe their judgments. Do not defile yourselves with their idols. And, you know, we're told a very similar thing in the New Testament. 1 Peter 1:18, Peter says, "For as much as you know that you were not redeemed with corruptible things, as silver and gold, from your vain conversation, received by tradition from your fathers." These things that we got by tradition from our fathers, that's not what has redeemed us. That's not what God has called us his children for. That's not the thing that's going to save us. Peter goes on to say, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot, who verily was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but was manifest in these last times for you. So we have an opportunity too, just like those people did. We are the children of people who have been following our traditions and vain ways and idolatry. Our ancestors have been ungodly people. We are Gentiles for the most part. But God has been willing to make an agreement with us, to give us an opportunity to receive the things that those people in time past have turned down and rejected. And so here he's doing the same thing. He's warning the children to then follow him. He says in verse 19, I am the Lord your God. Walk in my statutes and keep my judgments and do them and hallow my Sabbaths. And they shall be a sign between me and you that ye may know that I am the Lord your God. So these children, God wanted to be his. And he's given them an opportunity to do so. And we find when we get to the book of Deuteronomy, which is the second giving of the law, while they were there on the plains of Moab, that Moses refreshed their memory. They were a well-educated generation. He went over all this law again with them in the book of Deuteronomy and explained to them in detail what God wanted them to do and reestablished the promises and reestablished the judgments and the statutes and the Ten Commandments with his people. And so they knew what the law of God was. They had a fresh promise, a fresh opportunity now to do the things that God wanted them to do. And you see how in these verses 18 through 20, God is pleading with the people. Please do these things, and I'll be your God. And you may know that I am the Lord your God. Now, this idea of knowing that I am the Lord your God is to so live and so behave in such a way that there is no idolatry. There's no other God. There is no rival in your camp between you and me so far as another God goes. And one of the greatest sins that people can fall into is to become lax on the idea of knowing that God is God. He is the one, the only, the true, the living God. And we begin to give some kind of credence, some kind of power, some kind of honor to some other power, some other imaginary force. We start talking about being lucky and trusting in luck. We start knocking on wood when we make a statement. We start crossing our fingers. We get superstitious. We feel that there's some other power here in something that God has never attributed any power to, any glory to, any honor to. And when we do that, we're robbing God of his glory, and we don't really know that God is God of all. But in spite of this agreement that he made with them, in spite of all the meticulous care that God took with them to instruct them and well educate them, and in spite of the fact that they had been given the 40 years through the wilderness, they were now on the plains of Moab, they were now ready to go into Canaan, they still committed grievous sin. He says in verse 21, notwithstanding the children rebelled against me. So the fathers had been rebellious, now the children are rebelling. And he had given the children a fresh chance to do what's right and to receive all the promises. But the children rebelled against me. So it's not going to be a matter of the children being punished because of the sins of the fathers. The children are going to be punished because of the sins of the children. And they're just walking in the footsteps of the fathers. They're just filling up the iniquity of their ancestors. But it's their sins for which they will be punished. And we had this earlier in the book of Ezekiel. It's not right to say the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge, because God doesn't deal with people that way. He deals with each person on the basis of his or her own sins, the deeds that are done in their own bodies. So he says, notwithstanding the children rebelled against me, they walk not in my statutes, neither kept my judgments to do them, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. They polluted my Sabbaths. Then said I, I would pour out my fury upon them to accomplish my anger against them in the wilderness. So they absolutely did wrong. They did just like their fathers had done. They despised his judgments. They didn't walk in them. They didn't keep them. And he says, if a man will do them, he shall even live in them. But they polluted my Sabbaths. So here God once again, the third time, decides that he's going to pour out his fury against the people to accomplish his anger against them in the wilderness. And to really pour out his fury would be to annihilate them, to cause them to cease to be as a people, probably to cease to be, period, as far as their life on this earth goes. And he made this decision after the third time because of their great sin. Once in Egypt, once with the people who had been brought out of Egypt in the wilderness, and now here with the children of these people who have rebelled against him. Now, as we know, the first great sin that the people committed when they came out of the land of Egypt was the sin involving the golden calf there at Mount Sinai. Well, these children that he's talking about, after they had wandered now for 40 years and had come down to the plains of Moab and were about ready to go into the land of Canaan, it seems that their counterpart sin to this golden calf was the sin that was committed by Peor as they were in the this area of Moab. And we read about this in Numbers 25, beginning with the first verse. I'd like to read the first 9 verses of that chapter. And Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab. And they called the people unto the sacrifices of their gods, and the people did eat, and bowed down to their gods. And Israel joined himself unto Baal Peor. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And the Lord said unto Moses, take all the heads of the people, and hang them up before the Lord against the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may be turned away from Israel. And Moses said unto the judges of Israel, slay ye every one his men that were joined unto Baal Peor. And behold, one of the children of Israel came, and brought unto his brethren a Midianitish woman in the sight of Moses, and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel, who were weeping before the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose up from among the congregation, and took a javelin in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent, and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through her belly. So the plague was stayed from the children of Israel. And those that died in the plague were 24,000. And we learn, of course, that this person who had committed this sin, his name was Zimri. And if it hadn't been for the action of Phinehas to have taken matters into his own hands, the plague might not have been quieted at the time it was. But they lost 24,000 people in that plague. And this was a great sin, committing this fornication with the daughters of Moab, bowing down to their gods, serving them. And there were 24,000 people lost as a result of the plague that God brought on them at that time. And we find that that was a great and grievous sin, so much so that the people never seem to have been able to shake off the effects of it. In the book of Joshua, chapter 22, Joshua states toward the end of his life that they had never really been able to shake off the iniquity of Peor. He says in verse 17, is the iniquity of Peor too little for us, from which we are not cleansed unto this day, although there was a plague in the congregation of the Lord? God did bring this great plague. 24,000 died that day, but still the iniquity of it, he says, we haven't been cleansed from it unto this day. And this was years later that Joshua made this statement. So this was a great and grievous sin. And this people then, these sons, this next generation that God wanted to deal with, even they rebelled against me. And so we can see then how that they have deserved all of the bad things that have happened to them. They've asked for them time and time again. God has been within his rights to have completely annihilated them, but he didn't. He chose not to. and consequently the sins that they did suffer for, they suffered because they deserved it. Even Moses comments on the wickedness of this generation of people. In Deuteronomy 9:24, the very book in which he was given them again, for a second time, the law of God, he says, "You have been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you." Again, in Deuteronomy, the same book, chapter 31, verse 27, he says, "For I know thy rebellion and thy stiff neck. Behold, while I am yet alive with you this day, you have been rebellious against the Lord. And how much more after my death?" So this people certainly did live up to the reputation for having been a stiff-necked, rebellious people. And when God says here, "Notwithstanding the children rebelled against me, they walked not in my statutes, neither kept my judgments to do them," he is saying absolutely the way it was. But in verse 22 he says, "Nevertheless I withdrew mine hand and wrought for my name's sake, that it should not be put in the sight of the heathen, in whose sight I brought them forth." So God once again backs off from accomplishing and consummating his complete wrath. He withdrew his hand. He did not give this people all that they deserved to have given to them in the way of punishment. He did not completely destroy them. And the reason was for his name's sake, that his name should not be polluted in the sight of the heathen. All the world was watching, or all that immediate world in that vicinity was watching this people and what was happening to them. They knew that God had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They knew that he had brought them through the wilderness land, and that they had been promised to have this land of Canaan. And now if he failed to give them the promise, then his name would be maligned. And so in order to prevent a misunderstanding of his name on the part of the heathen, God did not destroy them at this time. Well, we're going to close at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying goodbye, friends.